Welcome to Province Sports Radio. Friday, I think we may be moving this around, but I'm Paul Chapman. This is I'm joined by Ed Willis. Ed, how are you?
I'm fine.
Done this for a while.
I'm on this Friday, Paul.
Yeah. No, this is a weekly podcast. So whatever day you're listening to it, we are recording it on the Friday. And you know, we can't avoid the topic of the Canucks. It was throwback week, and so appropriate that they were closing Rexall Place, because the Canucks against the Flames and Oilers really looked like we were back in the 80s, didn't it?
Well, it just an astonishing turn of events, because I'm sorry, most of this take is going to be through the eyes of a draftist, because they reel off that three-game winning streak against San Jose, Anaheim, and Los Angeles out of the blue when they hadn't been competitive against the best teams in the West all season, and that seemed to skewer, you know, any hope of getting in the top five. And now we're looking at seventh and eighth, and believe me, there is a huge difference between picking in the top five and picking seventh or eighth. Then they go ahead and lose, and all of a sudden they're right back in it. They're fourth now. The very good chance Columbus, and of course, that creates the whole John Tortorella storyline, which is too fabulous
to believe. Second round pick.
So exactly. So, well, no, just the fact that he can do more in winning these next two games than he did in a whole season for the Canucks. So if they come out of this picking in the top three, this is a massive development, an absolutely huge development for the organ. I'm excited about it. And again, you have to kind of, you have to turn this world on its head. You have to look at it as a bizarro world where you're actually pulling for the Canucks to finish last, or as close to last as they possibly can, because that's the best thing for this organization right now.
Well, it is. And the debate around whether that's good or not this year seems to have centered around, you know, that you don't try to lose. You don't want that in your culture, as they've pointed out with the Oilers, where no matter what your opinion is on the Oilers, that mix isn't right. And there's a lot of people blaming that on the constant losing. So you certainly don't want that. But the higher you pick, obviously, the better chance of getting a better player. No guarantees. That does seem to have flipped. You know, I think 2 months ago, people were talking about the Canucks needing a blue liner. Then when it looked like it was a top three pick, it's like, no, you take the best player available. Yeah. Then, as you said, they win three and everyone's like, oh, they're probably going to be seventh, eighth, so they'll be picking a blue liner even if they have to move back. Now they're in the conversation again to get a top pick.
This year is a little unusual, and there is such a line of demarcation between the top three and the next level. And those top three players, they're Austin Matthews, Patrick Laine, and Jesse Puljujärvi, are all first liners, all potential game changers. The other, what they'd be looking at are nice players, but you're also looking 2-3 years down the line before they make an impact. If they get Matthews, he steps into the lineup next season. The other two just might. The other two are impact players in the Finnish elite league as 17-year-olds, which is an astonishing development. And one of them, it's funny, they're both playing in the playoffs. Their teams are facing each other. And one of them is going to go to the World Under 18, and the other one is going to continue in the Finnish Elite League, which is just like a bizarre turn of events. But like I said, I think the biggest question about the Canucks going forward is where their top-end talent is going to come from. Jake Virtanen looks like he's going to be a player. He could go a couple of different ways, though. He's going to be an NHLer. Is he going to be that 30, 35 goal power forward? So many of their guys fit in, but those top three look like lead pipe cinch first liners, and that's what the Canucks need.
Well, it's funny. You talked about Virtanen, and obviously we've seen better things out of Horvat the last couple months. You know, McCann was sort of in the doghouse on the outskirts. He scores that great goal against the Kings, and you see that offensive skill there. Obviously, young players you're going to have an up and down year, and all of them have. But has anything really troubled you here down the stretch? To me, the difference between winning those three, obviously there's a big confidence issue, and losing the last two the way that they have is goaltending.
Yeah, well, no, and their goaltending has hit an awful lot of words. Believe me, if you give them Calgary's goaltending and you give Calgary the Canucks goaltending, Calgary's right in the playoff picture, and the Canucks are so far in last place. They've just dropped off the face of the earth. I don't really know if I'm troubled by it. Honestly, I'm a lot more encouraged by this draftist development than anything. I don't think it says anything profound about the culture, Willie Desjardins' ability to reach this team. team. They've kind of gone in ebbs and flows all year. I think, like we've been saying all along, and I think it holds true, unless ownership gets involved, the clock doesn't start ticking on Willie until about game 38 to 42 next year. And if they have fallen off, then yes, it's time for a change.
Sorry, what do you make of this experiment of playing Pedan at forward?
Well, what I make of it is he's not good enough to play defense in the NHL, which is too bad, because that's what they desperately...
Like, is that
I don't know that. Yeah, no, he's 21. I get all those things, but he offers something they need. They really need that physical presence, and he's a devastating fighter. The problem is, I go back to that game in St. Louis that I was at, and it was fourth and sixth night. St. Louis has this big, heavy team. They started running the Canucks in the first period, and this is the time for both Trampkin and Pedan to step up, and they had zero response in that game. And then that was disturbing on a number of levels. And I've seen it just a little too many times. He just doesn't seem willing to engage on a consistent basis. And that's the way he has to play to be effective. He's not going to be effective as like a puck mover or as a shutdown guy or any of the other things you think of as a defenseman. He's got to make it on his physical presence. And Trampkin is, you know, he's so far past him in terms of the plans for next year. So Pedan remains a project.
So the project part is what intrigues me, though. These games really do mean absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
So it's almost like, okay, yeah, he's nowhere near being an NHL-ready defenseman right now, but when the games mean nothing, to not give him the experience and play him in a position he's never played in almost tells me that this is their Hunter Shinkark. This guy is never going to be that for us. That's the organization's belief. So let's try him at forward because we don't believe he can ever be a defenseman. Because otherwise, you've lost one hell of a development opportunity, even if it's only a handful of games.
I agree with that. And I guess I would just say they have given him a bit of an opportunity. It hasn't been the same opportunity Trampkin has, but he hasn't shown as well as Trampkin has. So it has been more limited. But I think they just made the determination there's just not enough here for us to invest that playing time in him. Let's see if he can make it as a fourth line left winger, as an up and down guy, as a guy who'll take the body and provide that physical presence as well as the nuclear deterrent they need.
Now, the reason I was sticking on this point is, of course, we've talked about all year about Willie Desjardins and has he done enough developing the young players? Forget the record. That's been what we've talked about all year. Certainly the relationship with some members of the media seems to have devolved a little bit. Some frustration there. I think overall, how are you judging Willie? You say into next season, no doubt in your mind he's back as a coach?
I don't say no doubt because... I'm sorry, I can't do that. I can't step outside kind of what I know and the whole sort of like geopolitical landscape about the Canucks organization because he's Trevor's guy.
Yeah.
And Trevor has a lot invested in him. So I think he's going to go to the wall for him until the point where he just can't do it anymore. Would I bring him back? I don't know. It's kind of 50-50. And I think my opinion on these things is almost inconsequential. Like we've said so many times this year, he seems to be able to reach players. He seems to be able to get something out of them. But there's just too many nights where you're left scratching your head about ice time, about line deployment, about why this guy played here, why he met this line against that line. So, like I said, it's going to make the first half of next season very interesting.
Does Trent Green factor into that at all? Would they have to be concerned? Because I think someone's going to inquire this year.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. I don't see Trent Green as like a red hot coaching the way other guys have been. And I also don't see anybody out there that you'd gas Willie for to make sure you got this guy. I mean, who are the hot candidates?
Randy
Carlisle.
I mean, you look at
Mark Crawford. I mean,
look at what Barry Trotz has done in Washington. Yeah. You look at Boudreau in Anaheim. You know, the retread is still popular no matter how. Look how the shine came off Bielsma. Certainly Dallas Eakins. Anyone could succeed in Edmonton when you look in hindsight. Everyone has been given a shot. But this idea, like the NFL does go more with the coaching tree or with the trends. And if you look at hockey, I think they've tried to do that, and they just, it just doesn't work. The young guy who's appealing more can connect with those younger players. Doesn't seem to work. A hard ass like Barry Trotz, given some talent, now all of a sudden he's the best coach in the NHL.
No, I'm laughing because they're almost like archetypal characters from Hollywood. You've got, you know, you've got the retread. You've got the, you know, the young ingenue from the American Hockey League. You've got the guy who's put in his dues at junior and then, and graduated to an assistance job with a successful team. They all seem to fit a type, don't they?
Yeah. And like Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, that's right. Mr. Green, Mr. Pink, Mr. And I think, yeah, and Green kind of fits into that, you know, that AHL model. And I think he's a bona fide candidate. But like I said, I think Willie has to coach his way out of this job before they turn to Travis Green.
One more thing on the Canucks, which is interesting, and I love the phrase when it comes to athletics that no one beats father time. I saw this when Anderson Silva lost in UFC. Okay. You know, you're a big UFC guy. Father time is undefeated. And that really is true. You see certain guys who have, amazing success later in their careers, but eventually catches up to you. And you look at what's happened to the Sedins and whether there are injuries, whether it's a mental fatigue of having to carry the team all year, you know, next year they are a year older and, Is this franchise ready to diminish their role, or is that going to create an even bigger problem for this team next year as the young players are not going to make enough advancement to cover off whatever drop they have, which should be, again, according to science, a little more precipitous next year?
Well, yeah, but theoretically next year, they're not going to rely on them to the extent they have this year. Next year, theoretically, they have Brandon Sutter for the whole year. They have Bo Horvat with another year under his belt. They have Sven Berchi, who's, you know, produced at a 20-goal level over the last 60 games. Maybe they have one of those young impact forwards. So, you know, there are
Baser, who knows,
Yeah, they have some pieces in place there that I think would insulate them, and they can go ahead. What's really important for the Canucks is if the Sedins produce at a 60-point, 60, 65, even a 70-point level, and that's good enough for them to stay competitive. Because I don't think, I think it's unrealistic to expect anything more than that, but I think it's realistic to expect that. Daniel has 28 goals this year. He's a 30 goal scorer in the NHL now. That's elite production. So if that's good enough, then it'll be good enough for the Canucks to stay competitive. If it isn't, then I would submit the weakness isn't with the Sedins, it's with the rest of the lineup.
Now, speaking about elite production, let's look at Rogers.
Yes.
I saw some funny stuff come out this week. Obviously, they had some front office people in hockey broadcasting operations who lost their jobs, which is never good in any industry. But some stuff came out that they sold all their advertisers on the fact they were going to have a 10% increase in viewership over CBC and TSN in their first year. They didn't. They had a 16% drop. This year, they've seen a further 16% drop. And now they're staring at playoffs without the prop of one big market. I don't believe the rest of the country cares. Like in Vancouver, if they don't make, they're not going to watch more about Calgary or Winnipeg or Ottawa or whoever else is in. Maybe there's still rub for the Canadians. I don't know. But I just think overall, it's that one market, which if they went on a run would make your numbers look good. But it looks like there's a fair amount of disinterest. Their advertisers aren't happy. They spent an awful lot of money. What does this mean for that contract? Just small point, small sample. We ran a poll this week about whose hockey coverage you prefer, and our readers responded with, you know, over, I think, 700 people voted. It was over 80% said they still prefer TSN.
Yeah, no, I think it is a huge, huge mess for Sportsnet, and I think it looks great on them too. you know, they overpaid for the rights. You know, they used the Rogers checkbook to muscle their way in. They tried to recreate, you know, they tried to reinvent the wheel. They tried to recreate a product that had sold so well and for. Yeah. If you can't sell hockey in Canada, what can you do? And they have just made such a mess of it. You know, the other part of the equation is, and the kind of hook for the story was the Angus Reid poll that said 50% of Canadians are going to watch less of the playoffs. So what's that going to do? Now, in some respects, it's kind of been a perfect perfectly bad storm for Rogers with all the Canadian teams in the tank, including Toronto, which drives this whole thing. A good season out of Toronto
in the tank, or is that just where they've always been?
Like, fair enough. But I also, I went back, I did a little research, and I went back, and Scott Moore was quoted at the start of the season as saying, Mike Babcock is going to get more out of this team. This is a young and upcoming organization. We really believe the Toronto Maple Leafs are going to be in the mix this year. Well, they are in the mix. It's just, it happens to be the Austin Matthews sweepstakes. Now, can you see Toronto getting better next year, next couple of years? Certainly, yeah. But I mean, is that also what you're depending on? And they're just such huge questions about the way they've covered the game, the stars they've tried to create who just haven't connected with an audience. And like I said, I hate their coverage. I think it is unoriginal. I think it's journalistically unsound. And I'm not any happier with TSN. But this also creates another dynamic. TSN is going to cover the World Championships this year like it's a Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And they're putting
World Juniors, right?
Well, yeah, but that's where they're putting all the resources in. So, I mean, they will cover the playoffs, but not to the extent. So, I mean, that's another thing to watch here. And ultimately, who is getting disserved or who, you know, I believe it's the viewer, the consumer who's losing out in all of this.
Well, that's always, you know, it's the Chicago Tribune owned the Chicago Cubs, and do they get fair coverage, you know, or are you being sold a marketing thing? And it's the same thing with the Jays, right? Do we get more Jays than we want because they're owned by those people, or do the viewers get really do they get the coverage where the interest lies? And I think we know the answer to that. But I think one of the things you said, Ed, they didn't connect with the audience. And I think that's 100% the dynamic to go to the positives of TSN, even though they don't have games. When you looked at something like the trade deadline, the dynamic of, you know, Duthie, McKenzie, Ferraro, those guys is still head and shoulders above anything that the NHL puts out there. And it's a funny thing. We've seen this hockey culture that goes back to your 15. Don't stand out when you're going join your junior team. Don't be controversial. It's great that the NBA can throw a Charles Barkley out there who is an elite all-star Hall of Fame player who also has and a goofball, but has, you know, entertaining television. To me, the NHL hasn't found that. PJ Stock can try to be that, but he was such an irrelevant player that he doesn't connect. Damian Cox appears to be trying to troll his way out of things and just say things that he doesn't believe in to be outrageous. The mix on that panel of what, and it's a panel of like 40 people from what I can gather. It's just awful. And people complain about it up and down.
Yeah. I find it fascinating. You referenced the NBA because when I thought about this, I thought of the NFL and I thought, okay, now why does the NFL work better? It's got the same saturation coverage. It's got, you know, the same kind of, uncomfortable relationship between the league and the broadcasters.
Absolutely, yep. Great point.
All those things. But, and I went back to the personalities there. So when you've got Michael Irvin and you've got Marshall Faulk and then you've got Bill you know, whoever it is, and I'm probably mixing and matching.
No, you're right.
I mean, it's fascinating. It's the quality of the people they have, the personalities.
You care about what they have to say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm sorry. I've got, you know, I've known John Shannon for a long time. I have respect for him. I think he comes at it from a journalistic point of view and I like his contacts. Boy, beyond that, the list is starting to get thin. And that's why, I mean, TSN almost wins by default because they've got this familiar face, these familiar faces who have consumer confidence on their side. It doesn't really matter. I'm sorry, we should credit Dave Schultz from the Globe and Mail for providing a lot of the material on this stuff. But one of the things there was a quote from an unnamed TSN source because the presumption has always been Sportsnet is going to unload some NHL games to TSN. TSN says, no, we really don't want them.
Yeah. Well, why would you? Why would you want to split the cost on showing a Nashville-Columbus game, which is what you'd get? I mean, you're not going to get Chicago, LA tossed to you, right?
Yeah.
But that's something that drives me crazy. I don't want to get on the soccer tangent, but, you know, TSN buys the rights to something, and then the next thing is they're farming them out to another channel that you don't have. And so now half the games that you paid for last year, you're not getting because they've like basically subleased their contract. I think it's sleazy to begin with. Mm-hmm. But, you know, hockey that broadcaster's, you're absolutely right. I don't know what it is. They've got a lot of people invested in it. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe it's too many cooks, but they just have not connected with the audience at all. It's like trying to throw together. It's like the, you know, some of those Yankees teams where we'll go out and we'll buy as many players as we can, and it's just not there. You just don't see the results in the end. So I don't know where it goes. The playoffs are going to be interesting, though. Best case scenario, I guess, would see the California teams really do something special, have some good series, see Chicago and LA again like they were a couple years ago, and have the hockey speak for itself, and then have a landmark final. Who that is, I don't know. Is Ovechkin enough to get people interested from the East?
Sure.
It's
a fair question. And I think it'll play in the States, but I think when we're talking here on June 3rd,
what would the dream matchup be?
LA, Washington. Yeah. Anaheim, Washington, something, Chicago, Washington, anybody in Washington, and those three teams.
Oh, come on. Florida would be a great story, wouldn't it?
I'm sorry. We are really devaluing Pittsburgh and what they've done here in the last 6 weeks, which has come out of the blue, and they're doing it without Malkin, and now they're doing it without Marc-Andre Fleury. If this is the year they get the Magic back and Sidney puts that team on his back and carries them to a conference final, that'd be a fantastic story. And I guess it's possible, too.
Yep. Florida again interests me, not only because of Luongo, but I think Jágr. And it's always fun when you get a city like Miami because a deep player running into people really care.
Well, that's true if it was Miami, but it's more Sunrise, basically to Miami what Abbotsford is to Vancouver.
Let's finish by talking about the Masters. It's hard to tell where the interest is with this. I think the interest is obviously still high. It always is about the Masters, but you kind of need to wait to see who's in contention.
Yeah.
Spieth, obviously a great story as we've seen along, you know, but we're still in this post-Tiger era where I think we haven't seen the personalities grab people's imagination like he did. And that's unfair to say because he is a very generational athlete.
Well, they don't have that crossover star they do. So I think it's intensely fascinating for golf fans and even marginal golf fans because there's that group of four that's been identified of McIlroy's group of three, really. McIlroy, Day and Spieth, and then another layer of stars. So I think for the serious golf fan and even the casual golf fan, there's a lot of meat on that bone right now. But I still remain fascinated by Augusta National, by Masters, by the way that tournament is presented. And this year again, I was watching it before it came down this morning, and they have, I'm not sure how new it is because I'm pretty sure they did it last year, but this feature group presentation where they start televising the round early, but they only focus on four groups. So we didn't see Rory McIlroy this morning. We didn't see guys who are making moves, but we got to see Ernie Els on the off chance that he seven putted from 3 feet again, which I thought was terrible. That's unfair because he was playing with Jason Day, but there was something cringeworthy about the amount of airtime Ernie Els was getting this morning. But it's just like Augusta, they make up their own rules. They're just so self-important and they've always been that way. And I've covered a couple of Masters in my career and to see that thing up close really is quite something to watch, and it hasn't changed and it won't change for another 30-40 years.
What are you expecting out of the tournament, though? Do you think it's going to be one of that top group that wins, or
talk to me after. Yeah, I mean, if Spieth posts another number, like as we're sitting here talking, he hasn't gone out yet, but he's 6 under. If he shoots 68 today, that puts him 10 under. And I think the way the course is set up, it's not going to be a crazy number under par. I think 12, 13, 14 under will win it. He was 21 under last year. I just don't see anybody making a big move. Day kind of shot himself out of it on the back nine yesterday, which is too bad because that set up as an amazing duel, and maybe it still comes to pass. It's the one thing about Augusta is just the way it's shaped up. You have these huge swings from a group of holes to a group of holes because the eagle is in play and the double bogey is in play on a lot of those holes. So you can get these huge swings, and I would like to see a relevant back nine here.
Yeah, I think it's obviously
on Sunday, excuse me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It would be great to see. I think that's what can engage the casual fan because it's one of those events that you pay attention to. If you don't,
sure.
I love how everyone uses the Greater Hartford Open as a whipping boy when you're trying to make fun of something in golf. But the point being that it's the one landmark event, and if you've got something dramatic happening on the last day. It doesn't matter whether you like the sport or not. It's if you're involved in any sort of a competition, I think it's classic television. It's lucky to have Tiger involved in something.
Yeah, as much as I have trouble with the presentation and that, you know, that idea that they're covering this like it's a papal annunciation, there is something about that course that presents the most amazing theater, and they've done it consistently over the years. And the fact that they return there and people are familiar with the sights and the sounds, and they go 13, and they know 13, and there's the creek, and then 15, and that crazy second shot they have to hit, and all the holes really are, you know, they make statements in and by themselves. So,
well, I was just chuckling because I think that Jim Nance has like gone from being a very benign but top level announcer on the most conservative network to really being
self-parody.
Yeah, it really is. Like, you know, this whole thing that came out with him giving his tie away how at the NCAA, and this whole thing about Toast, which made – did you see that thing?
I didn't see Toast. And I was a little late to the tie thing, and I thought, really? Really?
Well,
you are so important.
Yeah, exactly.
That you giving a tie away to a senior represents –
this has become a great tradition,
huge
right?
Huge moment in you. Like, yeah, whatever.
So the Toast story went something along the lines that he was asked about being on the road and – something about he likes toast that's almost burned. He doesn't like soggy toast. And everywhere he went, he would have to send his toast back. And he and his wife actually came up with a formula that said that he had wasted 4 hours of his life sending toast back. Mm. And he was actually telling the story like the rest of us should give a shit. And then he says that his wife took a picture of toast, how he likes it, and he laminated it and put it in his wallet. And he would hand it to people at the hotel in the morning when he'd order his breakfast. Again, why we would care about this, I don't know, other than I bring it up because there's a story like that about Tony Gallagher.
Yeah, so well, I'm sorry, and I was just running it through my head, and I'm trying to figure out if the statute of limitations arrived on this one. I think we should really close with it because it is a spectacular Tony Gallagher story.
It's a funny story if you know Tony.
I am pretty sure it takes place at the Marriott in Minneapolis with his good buddy Al Strachan, because every great Tony story involves Strachan and vice versa. And they're having breakfast, and Tony's breakfast arrives, and the toast is on the plate with the eggs, and he looks at it like somebody has handed him a spittoon of warm spit and says, look at this toast. It's touched the eggs. If I wanted that, I would go to a Denny's. I expect my toast to be served on the side. So the waiter's very apologetic. So they come back for breakfast the next day. And somebody who appears to be a floor manager walks up and goes, excuse me, Mr. Gallagher. And Tony goes, yes. And the manager goes, I'd just like to thank you for pointing out the toast issue the other day. And you should know we have now made a policy change across all Marriott's that from now on toast will be served on a side plate. So thank you very much. And Tony actually got a little sheepish in this, and he looked at, so this is the punchline to the story. He looked at Strachan and goes, you're not going to tell anybody about this. And Strachan goes, oh yes, I am. So that was it. That's the power of Tony Gallagher. He effected a policy change on toast in all the Marriott's in North America. I don't know if it was worldwide, but it was,
well,
I think it was
he
North
and Jim
America.
Nance then peas in a pod. Yeah. If only Tony had known to take a picture of toast on a side plate, laminate it, keep it in his wallet.
Okay, this was before his cell phones. Okay. This was before his cell phones.
Yeah, he could have handed that to the waiter and got his toast how he liked it. Thanks for joining us, Ed. It's been a busy time. Canucks season limping to an end, crawling to an end, really. So thanks for listening, everyone. We will endeavor to do one of these next week as well. Ed, we'll talk to you next time.
Okay.